In Warsaw, U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the people of the free world.
We must remain unified today and tomorrow and the day after, and for the years and decades to come. It will not be easy. There will be cost, but it's a price we have to pay.
Plus, the U.S. says Russia is now changing its strategy 1 month into the fighting. But what does that mean moving forward?
Their main military objective, which was the toppling of the Ukrainian regime and the capturing of its territory, has completely failed.
And later in the program, the challenges prosecuting Russia's alleged human rights abuses in international courts. Today is Saturday, March 26th. From the Voice of America, this is a special edition of Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden has concluded his first European trip and is currently making his way to Air Force One and a return flight back to Washington. Prior to takeoff, Biden spoke for over 25 minutes about the Russian war in Ukraine and, as the White House put it, to the people of the world.
We stand with you.
The American president also refuted the Kremlin's pretenses for invading Ukraine.
Russia has strangled democracy, has sought to do so elsewhere, not only in his homeland. Under false claims of ethnic solidarity, there's invalidated neighboring nations. Putin has the gall to say he's denazifying Ukraine. It's a lie. It's just cynical. He knows that. And it's also obscene.
Biden rejected Russia's assertion that NATO wanted to destabilize Russia, saying nothing was farther from the truth, and that he also offered real diplomacy and concrete proposals to strengthen European security, enhance transparency, and build confidence.
But Putin and Russia meant each of the proposals with disinterest in any negotiation, with lies and ultimatums. Russia was bent on violence from the start.
President Biden also acknowledged that there would not be a quick or easy resolution to the fighting taking place in Ukraine, and stressed the need for solidarity.
We must remain unified today and tomorrow and the day after, and for the years and decades to come. It will not be easy. There will be cost, but it's a price we have to pay.
The president concluded his remarks by turning his attention directly toward Russian President Vladimir Putin.
A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never erase a people's love for liberty. Brutality will never grind down their will to be free. Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia, for free people refused to live in a world of hopelessness and darkness. We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principles, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
The president then thanked those in attendance and also prayed for the protection of troops before making his exit. VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze, who's been following the president during his European visit, shared more about the trip.
From my perspective, the president was received very well. He's very emotional. He speaks to the heart of the people, so people listen to him. However, people have a lot of expectations as well. Many people, when Ukrainians from refugees and the protests, asked me many times what to expect from President Biden. Would he close the sky? Would he give us enough missiles? Would he give us planes? So there are a lot of expectations. And this is very important that the United States would have a very particular message and very particular offers to Ukrainians at this point. Obviously, President clearly said that his goal is to meet refugees, to see firsthand the crisis, specifically in Poland, that took most of the refugees, and that people take it very well. They are happy about this. However, they obviously need more. As we speak, there is a big exposure and a bombing in near Lviv, and this is not far from where President Biden was yesterday, from Rzeszów. It's 60 miles from Rzeszów. So President Biden is wrapping up his his visit here, but Russians are keep bombing and closer to Polish border.
Miroslav, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that there have been calls for more to be done to help Ukraine. What has been the response to refugees you have spoken to as they hear this news?
The refugee, unfortunately, don't see much American help in terms of aid at this point. American aids are coming slowly. They're very happy with the military support that the United States and the West is giving to Ukraine. And just a few hours ago, Foreign Minister of Ukraine met with President Biden, and he thanked President and the United States for every military support that Ukraine is getting. However, the Ukrainian government, the President Zelensky, laid out a much more comprehensive ask from a military stand, and Ukrainians are still waiting for the green light for military support that the United States and the NATO are promising, as well as they are asking for anti-aircraft missiles, and they are asking for more planes. And that's what so far NATO and United States did not agree on.
Miroslava, can you also share some of what you have seen firsthand when speaking to the refugees there in Poland?
Poland has accepted a major share of over 4 million Ukrainians who have fled a month-old war. More than 2 million stayed in Poland. I talked to many people, and they received a lot of support from Polish government. They are very, very thankful for that. They said they received everything they need as fresh refugees. However, they do hope to go back. They do hope that war would end. People don't lose hope. They smile. They said, we cannot cry anymore.
Miroslava Gongadze, VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief. Thank you. You're listening to a special Saturday edition of VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. and Western officials said on Friday that despite their superior numbers, Russian forces continue to struggle in Ukraine and may now be changing their strategy. Russia's Deputy Chief of the General Staff, Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy, all but confirmed the change in focus, saying that the first stage of Russia's operation, focused on reducing Ukraine's fighting capacity, has generally been accomplished. He said that Russian forces are now focusing on their main goal, the liberation of Donbas. Western intelligence estimates, however, noted the shift in strategy may be in part in an effort to salvage a Russian war plan that has failed to topple Ukraine's government as quickly as hoped. Earlier today, I discussed the war 1 month into the conflict and the recent NATO meeting with Peter Campbell, a political science professor at Baylor University in Waco, Texas.
First thing I would say is that for myself and many other analysts of national security affairs, the extent of Putin's invasion of Ukraine was completely unexpected. I think initially I was thinking that there would be some kind of limited incursion into the Donbass to secure that for Russia in the same way that they secured Crimea, a larger military footprint. Instead, it looks like Putin went for a complete encirclement of Ukraine, an attack on multiple fronts, and an attempt to overthrow the Ukrainian government and capture all of its territory. The extent of Ukrainian resistance, however, was unexpected. The Ukrainians have fought back incredibly effectively, and not only because of weapons provided by NATO and the United States and other countries, but because of their incredible will to resist. The Russians have been robbed of a blitzkrieg-style victory, which I think that Putin was expecting. One of the dangers when you're making myths for your people, which is clear that Vladimir Putin is doing when you read his speeches, his pseudo-history of Ukraine, is that you can start to believe those myths. And I think Putin convinced himself that Ukraine was a house of cards, and that if he went in very, very strong and took advantage of surprise, that the entire country would topple and that he would take over rapidly.
So a month into things, what's your analysis? What do you make out of the Russian strategy, not only in its buildup to its invasion of Ukraine, but the tactics of striking civilian targets?
Well, so the attacks on civilian targets, I would say, are highly predictable. Actually, I've said in remarks publicly recently, they are the result of frustration at the inability of the Russian military to capture territory and secure vital military objectives. So when you're in the attack and being frustrated by a stalwart and effective defense, it can become very frustrating. And when your forces are not well motivated, as it seems very much that the Russian forces are not, the use of indiscriminate firepower becomes a proxy for actually using effective military forces.
Switching gears just slightly, I wanted to ask you about NATO, which just wrapped up its extraordinary meeting in Brussels, as well as the G7 and Council on Europe meetings that the president attended. There have been repeated statements being made that the leaders of the world do not want a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO and the United States. But how do you view NATO's response throughout this crisis?
Well, I was very happy to see that they had promised to send in more anti-aircraft weapons, more anti-tank weapons for the Ukrainians to use in the defense of their country. I think that's essential because if Vladimir Putin were determined to continue fighting and continue to use indiscriminate firepower as his main military tactic, the Ukrainians will eventually run out of ammunition and out of men. So they need more ammunition. They need more supplies. They need more logistical support. I would say, though, it is one thing to say that you will provide powerful means of resistance to a country that's under siege by another power. It's another thing to get the weapons to them. Right? So if the Russians are determined to continue to resist, to continue to fight and take back Ukraine, which now is unclear whether they will or not, they will try to destroy those shipments of weapons as they enter the country. And if they're successful at destroying some of those shipments, then NATO will be confronted with the choice of whether they want to use their own forces to protect those shipments as they come into the country, because as you know, the Ukrainian forces are kind of busy. So that will then bring in the prospect of escalation as the NATO forces attempt to protect those shipments as they come into the country. My sense is, if you tell your adversary that you want to avoid war at all costs, in my sense, that actually emboldens them to become more, not less aggressive.
The United States, NATO, and other world leaders have all expressed their hope that a diplomatic solution can be reached that will end the hostilities. But they also put it out there that any resolution must respect Ukraine's right to exist and its territorial integrity. Russia has now said that the military operation, the war in Ukraine, is there to liberate the Donbas region. So where do you see things going from here?
Steve, I'm glad that you brought up this declaration by the Russian general, I believe it was yesterday, who said that the actual purpose of the war was to distract and divert Ukrainian resistance away from the Donbass so that the Russians could capture it. And to me, that is a complete fabrication. It is a face-saving maneuver that the Russians have made in order to hide their main military objective, which was the toppling of the Ukrainian regime and the capturing of its territory, has completely failed. And the issue, in my estimation, just on my reading of the history of international relations since basically, you know, the Second World War and going into the Cold War, is that now the Russians will seek to negotiate, and one of their demands will be that the Donbass remain in Russian hands along with Crimea. And it is not clear to me that the NATO alliance will back up the Ukrainians to ensure that the Russians leave the Donbass and leave all the other areas of Ukraine that they've attacked since the beginning of the invasion about a month ago. So my sense is that the Russians are now signaling that they want to negotiate, but that they're going to hold on to Donbass. Now, that being said, I have to say that one of the things that this entire episode has shown me is that we should really be careful not to get into the prediction business. Because this, as I said, the scale of this attack was totally unexpected by myself and by others who work in the same field that I work in. So that's my read right now. Could the Russians actually just wait and then escalate more in the future? That's very possible as well. I think Putin and Russia have proven to be highly unpredictable in this instance.
Peter Campbell is an associate professor of political science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate it.
This special Saturday edition of VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine continues. I'm Steve Miller. With several investigations currently taking place aimed at determining whether or not Russia has committed alleged war crimes, I discussed that topic, and the challenges of bringing perpetrators to justice and more with Richard Wilson, the Gladstein Distinguished Chair of Human Rights, Professor of Anthropology and Law, and Founding Director of the Human Rights Institute at the University of Connecticut School of Law in Storrs. I began our conversation by asking him if what's being shown in Ukraine meets the legal definition of a war crime.
It was unclear at the very outset how Russia would conduct the war. But as the war progressed, it became more and more apparent that the Russians were going to use models of war that refer back to the medieval times, namely encircling cities and shelling those cities which have large civilian populations indiscriminately. And that is one of the definitions of war crimes. Extensive destruction of property not justified by military necessity and carried out wantonly. That's in Article 8 of the International Criminal Court Statute on War Crimes. So it does seem that the Russian military is intentionally directing attacks against the civilian population. And that's really one of the core essences of the concept of war crimes.
Now, are there any kind of guidelines in terms of tiers of crimes being committed? Because via reporting, there are shelling of apartment towers that may or may not be occupied at the time. There are, of course, the horrific pictures that came out in Mariupol of the school and the drama theater being targeted that was being used as shelters. And then the other reporting of civilians being attacked in evacuation corridors. So are there degrees in terms of what the legal status is?
Well, certainly all of those events that you've described would qualify as war crimes under Article 8(2)(b)(5) of the International Criminal Court Statute. Attacking or bombarding towns, villages, dwellings, or buildings which are undefended and which are not military objectives, that qualifies as a war crime. And certainly, if you're asking about degrees, it's particularly egregious that the Russians seem to be attacking humanitarian corridors. That first of all, they would negotiate some of these corridors and then not respect the terms that they negotiated and engage in mortar attacks on humanitarian corridors, in some instances killing civilians.
Now, Russia has said that it is not in the process of targeting civilians, and the United States itself also said that these are allegations and courts with proper jurisdiction must investigate them before final decision is made.
Yeah.
The UN's court in The Hague has opened up an inquiry. There are other inquiries going on. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what are the challenges that these different bodies face in trying to suss out the facts of the matter and then move forward with any kind of prosecution?
The problem that courts conventionally face is finding the evidence. gathering evidence during a hot war is very, very difficult. If the war is ongoing and you have two competing sides, and you're trying to collect evidence of war crimes, it's very difficult to get investigators in there to collect evidence that could be used in a court of law. Courts of law have very rigorous rules about evidence. They don't want to see evidence that's been tampered with or could have been introduced illegally. They would like to know that the investigators gathered evidence in a timely manner using rigorous techniques. But the war in Ukraine is not a murder on the streets of Miami. You can't tape off the area and put police on the perimeter and gather forensic evidence carefully. The war is, as I've just said, a very hot war, and the bombs are still coming down. So that makes the collection of evidence very difficult. But at the same time, we have, in some ways, we have better ways of collecting evidence because there's much more satellite imagery than there used to be. There's GIS, which maybe didn't exist in previous conflicts, if we go back 30 or so years. And so it's very important that if the Biden administration is serious about providing accountability in this conflict, that they work very hard to assist whatever court may be set up in the future, or the existing International Criminal Court or International Court of Justice, that they provide those courts with adequate evidence. And the U.S. government has very powerful methods of collecting a variety of forms of evidence.
Yeah, speaking of holding individuals accountable, that was one of the items that the Secretary of State released in his statement. What kind of challenges are there in terms of getting a judgment, whether it be from the ICC, the ICJ, or other international bodies, and holding individuals accountable for committing war crimes once they are determined to be such?
Yes, the jurisdictional questions are very complex. When Russia invaded in 2014 the eastern section of Ukraine, Ukraine made a temporary referral to the International Criminal Court to investigate, and that investigation is still ongoing. What they need to do now is to make another referral to the International Criminal Court, granting temporary jurisdiction so that the crimes that are committed going forward can be investigated by the International Criminal Court. So those jurisdictional questions are difficult. The prosecutor himself, Karim Khan, may launch an investigation on his own behalf into Ukraine, and he has announced that he will do that. So that is ongoing. But you're right that Russia is not a member of the International Criminal Court. And so holding individuals responsible will be difficult, although not impossible. So it may be that an indictment may be issued by the International Criminal Court against Vladimir Putin and his generals. And then it would be up to the Assembly of State Parties members to enforce that arrest warrant and hand him over to the court. It's not impossible. I said many years ago that Slobodan Milosevic would never be prosecuted, and indeed he was prosecuted. I believe I also said that General Pinochet would never be prosecuted, and he was prosecuted domestically. So there are many different avenues. There are international tribunals. There are national courts. There's also universal jurisdiction, which the German court recently convicting a Syrian general of torture and crimes against humanity.
Richard Wilson is the Gladstein Distinguished Chair of Human Rights at the University of Connecticut School of Law. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thank you very much, Steve.
And this has been a special Saturday edition of Flashpoint Ukraine. And on behalf of our entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.